I thank the organizers for inviting me to this institute. I am for the first time here and I like it very much. I'm going to talk about our recent joint work with William Cheney. It is about the fact which everyone knows that a projective space minus 2n plus 1 hyperplanes in general position is Kobayashi hyperbolic and hyperbolically embedded. Other language, this means that for every holomorphic curve from the unit disk to this, we have a bound for the spherical derivative, where this k depends only on n and the omitted hyperplanes. The spherical derivative is a measure of length distortion from the Poincaré metric in the unit disk to the Fubini-Studi metric here. Explicitly, it is can be given by this formula. Where, square, yeah. Square, here, okay. Where F naught Fj, Fn, is a homogeneous representation of our curve. It is less known, perhaps, who proved this first. His name is Dufresnoy. And this was in 1944. He derived this from Stratin's PhD thesis. Which I will discuss later if time remains. It's a very complicated work, still not completely understood, and there are several unsolved questions connected with it, but I will postpone its discussion. Well, Dufresnoy says that he has no idea what this constant is. The proof is non-constructive. The modern proof of this is based on the so-called Zaltzman lemma or Zaltzman rescaling, which is better known to the participants of this conference as Brody rescaling. So it says that they usually stated for compact manifolds, but in this case it also applies. So this follows from the fact that there exists no non-constant holomorphic curve F from C to M. So then you apply Brody rescaling, and even though M is not compact, it works here in this situation. and you obtain that this family is normal. Now, of course, this is a normality argument, which gives no constant, no explicit constant. So the main subject of my talk is how can one obtain explicit estimate, just a number, depending on the hyperplanes. Well, let me tell you the history of this problem. So, Cowen, in 1974, did this for PN minus very many hyperplanes by constructing a negatively curved metric by hand. So this gives a result for n equals 2. So for n equals 2, it's fine. Well, for n equals 1, this is a classical theorem of Landau. This is why my talk is called the generalization of Landau's theorem. And for n equals 1, even the discussion is on the level of the best possible constant and so on. So for some point configurations, the best possible constant is known. Okay, there were other attempts. The attempts were in the direction of making this constructive. These are Hall and Babets in 1986 to 84, but they obtain certain estimates, but they either deteriorate when you approach the boundary or something else. So this constant was not obtained. So the method we apply is a potential theoretic method. Which was proposed by Sodin and myself in 1980s. I noticed that this method is very robust and has a wide area of application. Originally, it was used to prove a form of second main theorem with nonlinear divisors conjectured by Schiffman. And then it was especially successful in another generalization of geometric function theory, namely to quasi-regular mappings in space, but this I will not discuss. And, recalling the problem session we had before yesterday, I have to say that this method not only involves little differentiation, it involves no differentiation whatsoever. No differential forms, no Wronskians, no nothing. On the other hand, I don't know any analogs of this method in number theory. Okay, so let me state the result. So, we describe our hyperplanes as by linear forms. And then consider the matrix, which is 2n plus 1 times n plus 1. And take any submatrix square submatrix and consider its condition number. Well, you have to take the eigenvalues of A star, which are positive. Okay? And then the constant is first some constant depending on dimension only, and then inf over all submatrices of lambda n over lambda naught cubed logarithm n plus 1 lambda n over lambda naught. Okay, so the dependence on the hyperplanes is visible very clearly here, but the constant Cn is somewhat embarrassing. Well, I shouldn't probably write it, but just to make sure that everything is completely explicit here. Where B is the binomial coefficient. So the dependence on dimension is not good. Okay? So now I explain the method. So let me prove the Picard theorem first, that every holomorphic curve from C to that thing is constant, and then we will see how to make explicit estimates in each step. Okay, so let Lj be the linear forms defining the hyperplanes, normalized then consider the following quantity by the norm, I always mean the Euclidean norm, and the cardinality of this index set is always n plus 1 in my talk. So this is also a norm. So on the unit ball, this is bounded like that. And now we define the functions. So f is our curve. And we define GJ as L, well, let me define UJ as log modulus L of LJ of F, and U as logarithm of the norm of F. Okay? So then these are harmonic. And this is subharmonic. And I denote by mu the least measure of this subharmonic function. Then it is easy to see that, well, mu is a positive measure and infinite. Mu of C is infinity. Well, otherwise the curve will be rational, and rational curve cannot omit so many things, or you can prove it otherwise. It's a very easy fact.
One can argue that this is a use of
differentiation.
Huh? One can argue that this is a use of differentiation.
What?
The Riesz measure.
Yeah, but it will not be used in the proof. It will not be used in the proof. Okay, it is just a proof of Picard theorem, just for pedagogical reasons I included. Okay? So now this inequality implies the following fact that soup of those UJs equals U plus O of 1. It's just from here. And I stress that I always use this convention. So this is for every I of cardinality n plus 1. So the whole method consists in considering this relation only and showing that this is impossible to have something like that. Well, the simplest way to explain why this is impossible is to get rid of this O of 1. To get rid of this O of 1, we use a very useful device, which is called Riemann's lemma. So suppose you have any positive measure, then there exists a sequence of disks such that the measure of a disk tends to infinity, but the measure of twice larger disk with the same center is less than constant times the measure of the original disk. That's for any positive measure, for any infinite positive measure. Well, we apply this to our measure mu and rescale in the following way. So we consider a rescaling factor which tends to infinity, u of z plus rk zeta, and now subtract the least harmonic majorant of u, this is the least harmonic majorant in twice larger disk. So, and we consider this for zeta less than 2. So then this is a sequence of negative subharmonic functions of bounded Ries measure. Negative subharmonic functions of bounded Ries measure. And such thing has to converge. It doesn't converge to minus infinity because these are potentials, and so it converges to honest subharmonic function. So this converges to some honest subharmonic function in the disk of radius 2. And the important fact is that it is not harmonic, in particular not identical constant or anything like that. Why is it not harmonic? It is because of this statement in the Riemann lemma. It has certain amount of measure, 1 over certain amount of measure in the disk of radius 1, certain definite amount of this measure. Now we do the same rescaling on UJ. By the same, I mean that we subtract the same harmonic majorant of U, not of UJ. So subtracted thing is the same, and the division factor is also the same, and obtain harmonic functions VJ, negative harmonic functions VJ. Now, because we divided by this factor which tends to infinity, the or term disappears, and we obtain that, so we have maximum over any set of cardinality n plus 1 of Vj harmonic functions equals V, where V is a subharmonic function, which is not harmonic. So Vj are harmonic, but V is not. This can be called, according to the current fashion, tropical version of Picard theorem. Addition is replaced by sup. Now, why is this impossible? What does this mean, actually? So the maximum of every n plus 1 things is the equal to the total maximum. This means that at every point, at most n things can be less than the total maximum. So if we define the I fail. Okay. Okay. So if we define the sets EI as the set of Z, where Vj of Z is strictly less than V for all I in I, then these sets cover. So one of them is of positive area. And applying this relation to this one, we obtain that V is harmonic. Because harmonic functions coincide if they coincide on the set of positive area. And on this set, these harmonic functions, oops, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So this is the definition of the set. Okay? So one of them is of positive measure. If two harmonic functions coincide of positive measure, they coincide everywhere. And I take in I naught and applying this relation, we obtain that V is harmonic and this is a contradiction. One little remark. No canonical class, not even dimension of the space was used. If you look at this proof, where does n plus 1 come from? Only from here, from the intersection pattern. Only from the intersection, set theoretic intersection pattern of our hyperplanes. There was no other n here in this argument. Okay. So now how to, let's see how to extract explicit constants from here. Well, the easiest part is the Riemann lemma. So we are going to do the same, but we will not obtain exactly the, tropical version, but have to still work with this and do estimates. So what modification is needed in Riemann's lemma? Well, we don't have this assumption anymore. So we suppose that mu is a measure, any measure, in the unit disk. And then it is claimed that there exist such disks that mu of the little disk is greater than something. One over 32 mu of the whole disk. And that's it. So that's essentially how Riemann lemma was originally stated. So there is no problem with that. So then then we obtain this relation, and then one quite complicated question is, what do we replace uniqueness theorem for harmonic functions with? There is no coincidence now, but there is almost coincidence. So the question is if two harmonic functions are very close on a set of substantial measure, then they are very close in the most of the disk. So this phenomenon is called propagation of smallness for harmonic functions. It is not just two constants theorem. Harmonic functions are not complex analytic functions. You cannot take a logarithm of harmonic function. Okay? So this is not a trivial question. And but of course it was studied even in arbitrary dimension. And the best result we know belongs to Nadirashvili. Let U be a harmonic function in the unit disk. And suppose that absolute U of Z is less than epsilon on a set E whose area is greater than alpha, then absolute U of Z is less than delta in the disk of radius 1/2, where delta depends on epsilon and alpha explicitly. The best theorem of this sort is due to Nadirashvili. It's early 70s. I mean the best constant here. There are other theorems of this sort. For example, of Donnelly and Pfefferman. This is also true for eigenfunctions, for Laplacian and so on. Well, just few short words of how this is proved. Everything is based on a classical inequality of Rammers. If you have a polynomial on minus 1, 1, then we have the following estimate. Well, a polynomial which is less than epsilon on a set of measure alpha, then it satisfies everywhere the estimate like this. That's classical. The one variable polynomial on minus 1, 1. Then by Fubini theorem, you spread it to two variable polynomials in a square or a disk. Then by polynomial approximation, only using the fact that harmonic functions are real analytic, real analytic with a series convergent in the fixed disk, and satisfying the estimate, I forgot here to say an important thing. And satisfying the estimate, they are nicely approximated by polynomials, so you pass from polynomials to harmonic functions, yes? What was what? Small e is the base of the natural logarithms. I'm sorry. And n is the degree of this polynomial. D is a degree of the polynomial.
No.
Yeah. Z is on the, here in this inequality, it's on minus 1, 1. But then you spread it to the plane and by repeated integration. And then you approximate harmonic functions by polynomials. This is how Nadirashvili's proof works. Yeah? No, it does depend because harmonicity is used in the following way. So from arbitrary set of area alpha, you pass to a disk of area alpha. And then for disks, you use the three-circle theorem. And the three-circle theorem is miraculously true for harmonic functions with exactly the same formulations as if they were analytic functions. And I will tell you the proof after my talk. That's a very interesting fact, even in space of arbitrary dimension. You don't take logarithm, but it is true. Okay, anyway. So this permits to run our argument in principle. But what do we get? So what did we begin with? We begin with a large Ries measure. And then, first it was infinite, then I explained that the large Ries measure will eventually lead to contradiction. But what is a Ries measure? What is the geometric function theory interpretation of the Ries measure of this U? Well, the formula was written in the previous talk. It is the area of the image, Fubini-Studi area of the image. The Ries measure of U is the Fubini-Studi area of the image, exactly. It's an integral of the square of this spherical derivative. Okay, so now this is not the whole business yet. So we estimated the area of the image. But we want a uniform estimate of the derivative. And the estimate of the area does not imply the uniform estimate of derivative. There is a Gromov compactness theorem about sequence of holomorphic curves with bounded area of the image. But it is clear that you do not have such estimate. So here comes another new ingredient. Well, what should I erase? Perhaps I will erase this last argument with Remes inequality. How do you pass from area estimate to the uniform estimate? Let's consider an example first. Let's consider f of z equals cz, yeah? A very nice example. The area of the image is less than the area of the sphere. It's injective. So the area of the image is less than 1. Derivative is c. You can choose c whatever you want. But it turns out that if your curve omits something, then such estimate exists. By the way, it seems to be new even in dimension 1. Okay? So let f be a curve from the unit disk to Pn minus, this time, n plus 1 hyperplanes is enough. Let's say coordinate hyperplanes. Okay? And let the area of the image is sigma. Then F sharp at 0 is at most 589 sigma plus 4, 25 log n plus 1. Well, of course, so for example, if you have a meromorphic function without poles and without zeros, or holomorphic function without zeros, and the area of the image is bounded by something, then it's a normal family. And with normal family with estimates. The spherical derivative is estimated like that. Well, of course, this estimate is not good when sigma is small. It is not zero when sigma is zero. Okay? There is a result of Dufresnoy. If sigma is less than one, well, I normalize that the total area of the Riemann sphere is one. If sigma is less than one, then the estimate is, of course, much better. And one doesn't need any assumptions about omitted hyperplanes. This is always true, and this follows from the isoperimetric inequality, ordinary, classical, not linear, classical isoperimetric inequality for the projective space or for the Riemann sphere. Okay, but as the example shows, this fails when sigma is greater than one, and this is what we have. This is what we have by for large sigma. This is also proved by potential theoretic method, and it is also simple once figured out and stated. So these are the main ingredients of the proof of the theorem. And now the question is, how much time do I have?
Well, 20 minutes.
Good. So then I can come back to the, well, if there are no questions, of course, about this. So I'm not going to tell anything more about the proof. The paper is posted on the archive and on my website and on Cherry's website. So if anyone wants to check the numbers, it's available.
Yep. Sigma,
it is sigma. It is not six. I'm sorry for my handwriting. sorry for my handwriting. Okay. So let me tell you something else. So let me go back here. Can one make a constructive proof of what Dufresnoy did? And this is related to a few other interesting questions, including unsolved questions. I mean, which I failed to solve, and everyone else. So perhaps it is useful to attract attention to these old unsolved questions, which remain from the very beginning of the subject of our conference, from Cartan's thesis. So let me recall the very first fact of all this science, Borel's theorem of 19th century. Okay? Let me try to state it precisely. So suppose that F1, Fp are entire functions without zeros. But their sum is zero. Then what? Then you can split them into groups. Such that for every group, the sum is zero, and within the group, the functions are proportional. So the only way to have such relation for functions without zeros is a trivial way, something like that. No other way. Well, this is a Picard-type theorem. And the modern formulation says that if a holomorphic curve omits n plus 2 hyperplanes, then it is linearly degenerate, and not only linearly degenerate, but you can tell where it is degenerate, to the so-called diagonal hyperplanes. And the equations of diagonal hyperplanes are obtained by setting these groups of variables, sum of these groups of variables equal to zero. So what is a corresponding normality statement? According to the Bloch principle, to each Picard-type theorem for meromorphic functions or holomorphic curves in C, there should correspond some normality statement, like to ordinary Picard theorem corresponds to Montel theorem. Well, this was explicitly asked by Bloch about this very same theorem, and we still have no answer. So let me tell you what Cartan proved and what was his conjecture. So what would be the natural conjecture? You have to replace constants by bounded. Every time when the work the word constant, of course, you want to replace bounded by the word bounded. Well, so consider a sequence of such vectors. So f j's are units, and summation zero, but this is a sequence, so I have to add some imaginary, some index k, and this k tends to infinity. I just don't want to write many indices. So then what would be the conjecture corresponding to this? Then you can choose a subsequence. One can choose a subsequence. Of case such that you can split them in groups this index set into disjoint groups such that in one group, if we take one function out and divide the rest by them, the ratios will be uniformly bounded on compact subsets, and some of these ratios will converge to zero. Okay? If one divide all members of a group. By some member, the ratios will be uniformly bounded. One has to be careful. One cannot say all ratios, because some ratios may tend to zero. So you cannot take the reciprocal, and some of these ratios tend to zero. So, by the way, it follows that each group contains at least two elements. Otherwise, how some can tend to zero? One of the terms of this sum is 1. We divide it by some function. So this is called Cartan's conjecture. From his thesis of 1928. So what did Cartan prove in his thesis? He proved that by the way, to avoid confusion, I have to relate this P with dimension. The P is related to dimension like this. Okay? So the first non-trivial statement we obtain when P equals 3, this corresponds to Montel's theorem, exactly. This is a restatement of Montel's theorem.
I guess
yeah.
They go to the
diagonal,
right?
Huh?
So that's one possibility. The other possibility is they go to the diagonal.
What?
It could also be that some...
Yeah, well, this is included here. This is included here. There can be one group. There can be two groups. Two groups define you a diagonal hyperplane. More than two groups define you some diagonal subspace of logical dimension. So what did Cartan prove? That, I will not repeat all these words. There exist at least two groups. One can do this either with unique group like this, or there exist at least two groups. Which may not cover the whole set of indices. So the corollary is that the conjecture is true for n equals 2. Cartan's paper is very, very clear, but for those who doesn't read French, it is completely translated and commented and explained in English in the last chapter of Lang's book. There's a lot of discussion. Okay, So this is a statement which Dufresnoy used in his original argument. I have to say that this proof is extremely complicated. It uses pullback of jets 15 or 20 years before Wiles and Alfords, and And but it is very technically complicated. I mean, there is a lot of cases to consider and a lot of technical things. Very hard to follow, but it is well written. So this is what Dufresnoy used, and there were attempts to make this proof constructive with explicit estimates, but they only add complexity, and they were not completely successful, as I said. So there was very little progress since 1928, and let me report the progress. So first, the conjecture is wrong, as stated. For n equals 3 and more. But it seems to be easy to fix. So here is my conjecture. If the assumption of Cartan conjecture is true in the unit disk, then the conclusion holds in some disk of smaller radius. Why did I make this conjecture? Because I proved it for n equals 3. With R3, 1 over 40. Well, of course, it doesn't matter that this is a concentric disk. Everything is Möbius invariant. You can make arbitrary changes of the independent variable. So one has to say in a hyperbolic disk about every point. Well, then you may ask, why cannot you cover with these disks the whole thing? You cannot. Because these Cartan classes, the partition of the indices into classes may not be unique. such a strange thing, but despite my best efforts, I could neither prove nor disprove this for higher dimensions, for dimensions of higher than 3. So I invite younger participants to think about this problem. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.